We're continuing our series on life, death and resurrection. And what we've been doing the last few weeks is just looking at some passages that, for whatever reason, we haven't looked at earlier in the series, but I felt that we should look at. Particularly the last few weeks, we've looked at that phrase, absent from the body, present with the Lord, which is actually a misquote from 2 Corinthians 5. And the idea there is you'll often hear that quoted at funerals as if it is a statement of doctrine that when a believer dies, they are absent from the body and their real self goes to be with the Lord in heaven. But of course, that's, as we've looked at, that wasn't at all what Paul was saying. He was saying that he'd prefer to be with the Lord and not in his present body. So with that in mind, last week we looked at Elijah, who was said to have been taken to heaven, and I hope I convinced you that I don't think Elijah was taken to be with the Lord in heaven at all. I think he was picked up by a whirlwind and placed down somewhere else, some distance away, where he continued his ministry. And tonight we're going to look at sort of a similar passage, in one sense anyway, and we're going to consider the issue of the thief on the cross. Now, a lot of you will know this, I'm sure. We've made reference to it many times, but I'd just like to look at it in a little bit more detail and bring up one or two issues that perhaps we don't always get time to talk about. Alright, well, the key issue, or the key verse here, if I can read this, just all gone blurry, is verse 43. I'm not going to give you the whole context. I'm hoping that you know really what's happening here. This, of course, is the crucifixion, and is the last hours of the Lord's earthly life. And he is, of course, on the cross, and there are other criminals on the crosses with him. Now, some people believe that there were two other criminals. Some people say there were maybe four or five other criminals. That's just not our issue tonight. If you are interested, there's an appendix in the Companion Bible that suggests some other points of view on that. But the verse here that I've got in mind is, we read verse 43, Jesus answered him, that is the thief, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. Today you will be with me in paradise. And if we just go back a few verses, we'll get a little bit more context. We read verse 38. There was a written notice above him, that is above the Lord, which read, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." And in fact, that we hear similar insults from those who were standing on the ground, who were his opponents as well. If you're really the Son of God, come and save yourself. Verse 40. So that's one point of view. But then the other, we read verse 40, but the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." Now, most of you will have a translation that says something like this, "I tell you the truth, comma, today you will be with me in paradise." Has anyone got anything different to that? I think they'd probably just about all say that, all the ones I've seen. "I tell you the truth." Have you got one after the word truth?
Yeah, actually that other comment. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe.
Good. Well, that of course is what I'm going to suggest too, is that really the comma belongs after the word today. I think, again, we've brought this up on a number of occasions in different contexts, not always when we're talking about this particular subject. But that's what I'm going to suggest to you tonight, that we read that as, "I tell you the truth," "I tell you the truth today, comma, you will be with me in paradise." Now, of course, the idea there is, or the suggestion, what is being implied in your translation when we have the comma after the word truth, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. The inference is that the thief gained salvation at that point, and having died a few hours later, he then went directly to heaven, which is another name for paradise. Now, there's a few things wrong with that sentence, I believe, yeah, theologically speaking, and I hope to talk about some of that tonight.
The study notes in the NIV, it actually says the word paradise is the word garden. It refers to a place of bliss and rest between death and resurrection.
Well, they got the first part right. When the notes there say that paradise means garden, that I would absolutely agree with. And then what's the next part? They say it's a state of bliss. Bliss and rest between death and resurrection. Well, that part I wouldn't agree with. I think that's completely wrong, that one. There's actually not that many references to paradise in the scriptures, believe it or not. And we'll get to that in due course. All right, well, before I give you some reasons why I think that comma should be there, and I think most of you probably agree anyway, but anyway, I want you to see what the translators actually had to go off, because that's what the original looked like. That particular page is from what's called the Codex Sinaiticus, which is a manuscript of the Greek New Testament, and you can see it's really difficult to read. I've done a couple of years of Greek, and I find that incredibly difficult to read. In fact, I can barely make any sense out of it myself. Just to show you something that's a little easier, here's our verse up here. He said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in the paradise." That is a literal translation of what we're about to see here. The original Greek texts were handwritten. I'll just go back to that previous screen. They were handwritten. They're all capitals. There's no word breaks, so there's no spaces between the words. Words will often start on one line and go next line, and there's no hyphen. So when we do that in our language, we sometimes will have a hyphen at the end of a long word, or in the middle of a long word, I should say, at the end of the line, to go on to the next line. There's nothing like that. There were no verse numbers, no chapter numbers, and very often there are no chapter breaks. Those were added much, much later. Well, the issue here is that there's no punctuation. We don't know where that comma is. It was meant to be. Now, here's a close-up of a different manuscript. I couldn't actually read the verse on that other manuscript. I couldn't find the words I needed to find. The reproduction was so poor. Here's a different one, and even that is really difficult. I've stared at that a couple of times today, and I can sort of nut it out now. But when I first saw it, I couldn't really make head or tail of it. That's the sentence there. "And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in the paradise." Well, now, just to make it a little bit easier, some of you have studied some Greek, some of you will know these letters. Here's a different version of it. And I've put some lines in between the words there, so you can actually see where they might come. And then I've also tied it up some of the words. You see the letters here. So, for instance, that's an E or an epsilon. That's right, and well, what we looks like an H to us, yes, an eta. And that's very common. And you find that this is actually a problem in some of the translations. When you read your NIV notes or your whatever study notes, often it'll say this word, and there'll be a margin note, it could mean or this word. And it's very often because they can't tell whether that's an O, or that's actually a sigma, a C. It looks like a C, but it's an S. Sometimes this is an epsilon, an E. You could actually mistake that for a theta, which is like a circle with a line through it, in the middle of it, the TH sound. And so some of the letters can actually get a little confusing. Here's one where I've doctored. That's an alpha, an A. But it looks like just two sides of a triangle, which is an L. So that's what it should be down there.
It could be the same as the delta.
It's very similar to the delta, correct, yes, to the D. So these are some of the problems that the translators have to deal with. Let alone, like, dealing with that is hard enough, But then, much further down the track, well, where do you put the punctuation? Okay, it's a little technical, but I hope that just gives you some appreciation of the difficulty. What I'm really trying to highlight there is that you've got all these issues, and one of them is that there's no punctuation. And so, of course, in verse 43, if you'd like to look at your Bibles there, where we put that comma is very much up to the translator. And most of the time, they've decided to put it after the word truth. I tell you the truth, comma. Today you will be with me in paradise. But that's what they had to work with, was a mass of letters, all stuck together, all running together. No word breaks, no punctuation. And so it's very much a bias of the translators. And I suggest to you, of course, it's I tell you the truth today, you will be with me in paradise. Well, I'd like you to put a bookmark in that verse, because I want us to consider a few reasons why this is, why it's a better translation. Again, you'll probably know a lot of these, but I hope it's a good reminder for you. The first thing we should remind ourselves is that the Lord himself, after he died, was in the tomb for 3 days. He wasn't in a place called paradise. He wasn't alive in any way for those 3 days. So it's totally impossible for him to have said to another person, well, I'm dying today, but you'll be with me in a better place today. Well, it didn't work that way, did it?
No.
It didn't work that way. What took place was that the Lord was in the tomb for 3 days, and that thief was going to a tomb, or the grave anyway, somewhere. Let's just remind ourselves of these things. You know them well, but let's just remind ourselves. Put your bookmark there, and we'll go to Mark chapter 8.
And just while we're turning over, even the creeds, which are not always right, they don't say he went to paradise, they say he descended into hell.
He descended into hell. And there's a reason for that too, which we'll get to in a moment. Mark 8, 31. Again, you know these things, but I think it's always a worthwhile exercise to read the scriptures and just remind ourselves of them. Mark 8, 31 tells us, while the Lord was still alive, it says, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. So he was going to be dead for 3 days. There's just no other way to put it. He was going to be dead for 3 days. Let's go back to Matthew 27. It's almost the last chapter of Matthew. Matthew chapter 27, verse 63. Now this is after the crucifixion. In fact, we'll read it from verse 62. So we're in Matthew 27, verse 62. This is after the resurrection. It's after the crucifixion. So the Lord is still in the tomb. It says, the next day, the one after the preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver, and of course they're referring to the Lord here because these are his enemies, while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead, which is exactly, partly what they did. They did tell them that he'd been raised from the dead, but they didn't have to steal the body to do it, did they? This last deception will be worse than the first, and of course that's their take on things. So even they had heard and had it in the back of their mind, well, he had said that he would be in the grave for 3 days.
What's the first deception?
Well, the first deception, according to them, is that he was claiming to be the Son of God, the promised Messiah, which they didn't agree with.
Being last, worse than the first. Absolutely.
That's right. And it's very true, isn't it, for us? Absolutely. It's so relevant for us. All right, let's go back now to Matthew 12. I'm just reinforcing here that the Lord was well and truly dead, and he was in the grave that day. He wasn't floating in a better place called heaven or paradise or anything else. He was dead in all the ways that we've talked about over the last few weeks. Matthew 12, we'll pick it up at verse 38. Here's his enemies again. We read, "Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, 'Teacher, we want to see a miraculous sign from you.'" By the way, this is Matthew 12, and the last three chapters are chock-a-block full of miracles. Miracle after miracle after miracle, from about chapter 8, chapter 9, and then his disciples in chapter 10 are performing many, many miracles. And really, this is just a test. "Teacher, we want to see a miraculous sign from you." He answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation ask for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." And then he goes on, because he's not just talking about his resurrection or death and resurrection for no point. He says, "The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now one greater than Jonah is here." So there's a lot that's interesting in that passage, but the point there is, again, the Lord affirms that he will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Not today I will be in paradise. There's one more passage I'd like you to look at in Acts 2, and it relates a little bit to what Athel was saying a moment ago. So Acts chapter 2, I think it's the Apostles' Creed. There may be other creeds, but it's the Apostles' Creed that talks about how the Lord descended into hell and then on the third day he rose. Well, the word hell in this instance here is Hades. And Hades, as I hope you remember, is another way of saying Sheol from the Old Testament. It's the state of death. It's gravedom or the grave. It's nothing more. It's just the state of death. So verse 30 to 31. This is Peter talking on the day of Pentecost. And he's referring here to David. It says, "But he was a prophet and knew that God had promised him an oath that he would place one of his descendants on his throne," so one of David's descendants on the throne. "Seeing what was ahead, he," that's David, "spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to the grave," or abandoned to Hades, or hell, if you're reading a King James, I'm not sure if it says the word hell there, "nor did his body see decay. God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of this fact." And if you go back to verse 27, there's a quote from a psalm, one of David's psalms, and it says, "Because you will not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay." And that, of course, is exactly what happened with the Lord. He was not left in the grave. He didn't stay in the grave after he died. He rose again. And interestingly too, his body didn't see decay at all. That's, again, another issue. All right, so the point of all those verses, I'm just trying to reaffirm there, that when we read, or perhaps consider, that the Lord was going somewhere else on the day that he was crucified, he didn't. He went to Hades. He went to the state of death. And he couldn't say to anyone else, "You'll be with me in a better place today, in this place of bliss," because he wasn't going there. He was going into the grave. All right, well, there's another reason why I think we should put a comma there. Oh, I didn't actually show you that one, did I? That's where I think the comma should go. There's another reason, and that is that resurrection is necessary for the future life of the believer, but there is an order. And I hope you remember, I don't think we'll go there, we've looked at it a few times. In 1 Corinthians 15:23, we read how there's an order of resurrection. It's Christ, the first fruits, right? The first offering, if you like, the first of the harvest, to put it another way. So the thief could not have gone straight to heaven, because that would have preceded the Lord's own resurrection. Do you see what I'm saying? There is an order. Christ's resurrection wasn't for another 3 days. The Lord couldn't, that thief couldn't have gone straight to heaven or been given life again straight away. It is Christ first, then others. And in fact, of course, it says in 1 Corinthians 15:23 that it is Christ the first fruits, then those who are Christ's at his coming. So it's all still future.
Yes, but let me play devil's advocate here.
Go ahead. You've never done it before, so go ahead.
No, but I mean it sincerely. Those who oppose our view on this could say, yes, but that thief going to heaven that day is not the resurrection. His body would still have been resurrected later. So
some people would say that, not everyone. And of course, well, you know, I'm hoping that this is all in the context of understanding what those fundamentals that we looked at however many weeks ago to do with life and death, that at the point of death a person dies, they are unconscious, they are dead in every way. But yeah, I take your point there.
The important words there to me are "with me."
Yeah.
And if he was saying that to that thief, that today you'll be with me, then he was lying.
Because the Lord didn't go there.
He wasn't with him in paradise.
He wasn't given that bloke any sort of solace at all. The bloke would have got there and said, well, where is he?
That's true.
Promise me,
and aren't you God? Oh yeah, but I tell the occasional fib.
No, well, of course, and we don't accept that, do we?
No. But that's what they're saying. Without thinking it through, I'm sure they wouldn't say it.
But you need to look at the verse before it. It says, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
I want to talk a little bit more about that in a moment, okay? So it's No. not shut up, just good observation, but we'll get to it shortly. Yes, okay. The other verse I'd like to remind you of course, is John 3:13, and we looked at that, I think, the last couple of weeks, that no man has ascended to heaven. That's when the Lord's talking to Nicodemus. And he says, no man has ascended to heaven. And that includes people like David, who we are told in Acts 2. I think it's even that verse. You've got Acts 2 in front of you there, haven't you? It says, verse 34, David did not ascend to heaven. Now, David is called in a number of places, he's called a man after God's own heart. So if anyone was going to be blessed in this way, you're given a special blessing by being in heaven with the Lord after death, it'd be David. But even he had not ascended to heaven. And it says that his tomb was there, I've just lost the verse there, I think it says that his tomb is there with his fathers. 29, thank you, yes, David. I tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here today. So, all right. So there's another point. The resurrection is necessary for the future life.
To be understood by them, mustn't it, win that argument? But David wasn't there, because he's saying this is proof that David wasn't talking about himself. You know? So when he said, you know, when he uses that argument to go back 2,000 years ago, that hadn't been Roman Catholic. It seems to me that the people at that time would accept that argument.
I think so. I mean, we're using these verses, well, I shouldn't include you, I'm using these verses this evening to talk about issues of conditional immortality, but really that's not the context of this passage at all. It's showing how this Jesus of Nazareth was the promised Messiah. He was dead, but he was raised now as the Son of God. All right, here's another point here why I think this should be, the comma should go there, and it should read, truly I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise. Because there are several examples of this word today being used as in emphasis. So I tell you today, and I'll get you to go back to Exodus 34. And I think this illustrates it very nicely. We're going to look at a number of verses here in the next few minutes that have this word today in it, or this day. But you can actually take that word out of the sentence, and the sentence still makes sense, but it's there for emphasis. Now, this is in the law, and the children of Israel are still in the wilderness very early on. They've probably only been there maybe a year, I'm guessing, certainly no more than 2 years, but I think about a year. And verse 11 is the verse I want. It says, "Obey what I command you today. I will drive out before you the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." Now, all of those tribes, the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, were all in the Promised Land. So that was going to happen 40 years down the track. 40 years or more down the track, actually. If we do the same thing to this sentence and we change the commas, let's put it in a different point, a different part. It says, obey what I... Verse 11, we're in chapter 34, verse 11. Let's just play around with that comma a little bit, and I'll put a different emphasis on it. Obey what I command you, comma. Today I will drive out before you the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites. Well, that's wrong. It's totally wrong, because it didn't happen for another 40 years. And yet in the Old Testament Hebrew there's no comma, there's no punctuation, so that the translators have done something quite sensible here, and they've recognised the word today there is for emphasis. You can take the word out and it still makes sense. Obey what I command you. I will drive out before you the Amorites, Canaanites, you know, just still makes sense. But the word today, it has an emphasis, doesn't it? It really makes it a bit more, emphasises the reality of the fact or something. And it stresses the point. It's not something vague. It's not something that's nebulous. It's today. It's to you. It refers to you. I'm saying this today. I'm emphasising it. And this is exactly what I think the Lord on the cross was doing. Obey what I command you today. I will drive out before you the Amorites, etc., etc. Let's go forward a couple of books to Deuteronomy chapter 4. I suppose what I'm trying to emphasise there is that what was promised didn't take place for another 40 years or so, and there's a parallel there with what the Lord promised the thief on the cross. He promised it today, so to speak, but it will be fulfilled sometime in the future. All right, Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 26. There's an example for us to look at. Verse 26, all part of the law. Now this is just before the children of Israel are going into the land. This is a little closer to that time. We read, "I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you this day that you will quickly perish from the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess." Now, let's just think about that. They're about to go into the land. They're maybe only a month or two away from crossing the Jordan and going into the land. And he says, "I call heaven and earth as witness against you this day, comma." Now, there's no comma actually in my translation, but that's where the comma is. "That you will quickly perish from the land you are crossing, the Jordan, to possess." Let's change the emphasis and see if it makes sense, which it won't. "I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, comma. This day you will quickly perish from the land you are crossing the Jordan to possess." Well, they didn't cross it that day. They crossed it in a month or two's time. The emphasis is there to say, look, I'm trying to get through to you today. Learn this today, if you like. Take this point today. All right, there's another verse, 39. "Acknowledge and take to heart this day that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other." Now that doesn't quite, it's not exactly the same as the other examples, but it does talk about this day. "Acknowledge and take to heart this day that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other. Keep his decrees and commands, which I am giving to you today," right? He's emphasizing it, making it real to them, "so that it may go well with you and your children after you, and that you may live long in the land the Lord your God gives you for all time." So again, if you make that today mean I'm giving you the land directly today, you're about to go into the... It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. It's there for emphasis, and it's exactly the same as what we have here in the example in Luke 23. Look, there's quite a few other examples we could read. If you want to take some notes, there's some in chapter 8, chapter 11, also Acts 20. We won't read them now because I want to just go and have a look at one other point. Let's go back to Luke 23. Hopefully you have that bookmarked still. So, in summary, just while you're going there, there's three, at least three reasons, and I'm about to give you another one, why I think this is saying that the Lord is just emphasising that the thief will be with him in paradise in some other time. Firstly, the Lord himself was in the tomb for 3 days. Secondly, resurrection is necessary for future life, and that resurrection has an order. Christ must be resurrected first. And then we get several examples of this, I tell you today, which just are there for emphasis, not of things that will take place today as such. And the other here is that I want to talk about this word paradise, and we're going to get to that verse Janelle mentioned too about the kingdom. Let's read those verses again, 42. So we're in Luke 23, verse 42. Then he, that's the repentant thief, then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus answered him, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. The question of what paradise is, I think, should come up in our mind here. And unfortunately, it's not mentioned too many times. It's a little difficult, but I do have a suggestion for you. Again, put your bookmark there, and I'd like you to go to Revelation chapter 2. It's mentioned only 3 times in the New Testament, by the way, paradise. That's one of them in Luke 23. The other one's in Revelation 2. And there's another one in 2 Corinthians we'll just refer to briefly. So we're just considering what is paradise here. What's actually being said here? Revelation 2. We're in a portion here where there's several letters being written to 7 churches. And really, I just want to focus on verse 7. Chapter 2, verse 7 of Revelation. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, that is, endures the adversity, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Now, I think that word paradise is perhaps best translated as garden. A number of times in the Old Testament, I hope you're familiar with the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament. So the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew, but there was a Greek version written, and that word paradise turns up quite a few times. I'm not sure exactly, but it's around about 20 times. It might even be more than that. And it always refers to either the Garden of Eden, or it refers to a garden, a lush garden. I think it's translated forest one time. It's a place teeming with life. It's not a place of death. Dead people are never mentioned in that context. And so here we have this verse here that says, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life. Now, hopefully your mind's ticking there to a couple of things. Firstly, there was a tree of life in the Garden of Eden, but we're not actually talking about this one. We're talking about the tree of life which is in the paradise of God, and we'll read about that in the last chapter of Revelation, chapter 22. So we're looking at this word paradise because this is what the Lord promised the thief. So we're just trying to establish for a moment here, what was he actually promising the thief? Chapter 22. Now this is in the context of an angel showing John the New Jerusalem and the New Earth. Chapter 22, verse 1. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. That's an interesting verse here. And I think personally, without getting too far off the subject, I think that refers to nations who perhaps at the end of chapter 20, at the end of the millennium, they're being there's a rebellion against the millennial kingdom of Christ. Satan is loose for a little season. Various nations will rise up, and many of them are going to meet a very swift end, but some nations will survive into this next phase of God's plan. That's what I believe anyway, and I think that that's what this is referring to, but that's perhaps for another study. About the nations here, yes. So there is a city, and then there are nations around the city, and these are nations that have not been destroyed at the end of the millennium. Perhaps if I put up a chart here, there you go. We're talking about, where's my little pointer here? We're talking about this time here. So just there. So at the end of 1,000 years, the kingdom, in fact you've got it there, haven't you? We're pretty close to it. No, we'll get to that in a moment. We're talking about here, this time here, the new Jerusalem, new heavens and new earth. And it's referred to in Revelation 2, there's the paradise, the tree of life in the paradise of God, and here we read about this paradise, about this tree of life. And I think this is really what the thief was being promised. That's my opinion, and may not agree with that, but yes.
Yeah, well, the thief doesn't say, you're not getting this because of who you are, you're the Son of God, and you know. He got that blessing, or that blessing, because he stood up for God, for Christ, didn't he? He stood up and he said, well, he's not a sinner. He doesn't go in there, you know, and I believe he's the Son of God, and and that's what these nations that get into that, you know, you're talking about, are really there for, because they stood up for Israel. It's not so much a faith thing, is it, like in the way of faith, accepting Christ as our Saviour. They stood up for Israel in that time.
Yeah, there's a few things in what you've just said there, John, I'd like to comment on. We're not really told an awful lot about what those nations do. I think at the very least, they are not opposing God.
Well, we know some things they did. They visited him in prison.
Yeah, but that's before the millennium.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
Yes, I know, but I think that they will then go.
They may well.
Into the new earth.
They may.
And it may be an Edenic sort of thing, you know, like where the exactly like Adam lived in, with the tree of life, the healing. But they're not in the New Jerusalem, because they've got to be a believer to be in there.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
So what do you do in verse 24 and 21?
So chapter 21, verse 24.
Verse 24. And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honour into it. And the one before is talking about the New Jerusalem.
Well, I think that's a variant on what happens in the millennial kingdom.
They're
honouring, and they're also honouring and bringing gifts, worship, however you want to say it.
In the 1,000-year run.
Yes, I think that what happens there is a picture of what happens there later on. Because you're talking about the kings, and they will walk in the light of the city, right? So we're talking about the New Jerusalem, the later point here. So, very similar situation.
On that new earth, the Israelite, not the one who's saved, but the one who had God's law put in his heart, you know, you're my people now, I'm going to do this whether you want or not. After the kingdom, my opinion, that they will go into the new earth as well.
Well, they may well.
I'm not talking about to accept Christ, I'm talking about the ones who were made worthy by God said, you know, the new covenant. People. The ones who are not there by faith, they're there because they are redeemed out of Egypt.
I'm not really in a position to say yes, I wholeheartedly agree or disagree, but what I can say is I think those people who get past that point, they didn't oppose God. To me, there seems to be several classes of people in God's scheme of things here, or how can I say, in his dealings with man. It might take me a few goes to get this out. But there are some who God sort of tolerates, and there are others who he will not tolerate because they just out and out opposed and set about to either bring down God's man or God himself, if they're that stupid, and they actually oppose, vehemently oppose. And that's where I think the difference is between, say, a group like the Pharisees and the scribes, who actively sought to bring down Jesus of Nazareth and crucify him, as opposed to the general population who perhaps didn't accept or were just in the middle there somewhere. They didn't know, they didn't... To me, there seems to be that group of people there too. And that may well be the nations that are being spoken about there. I'm really not certain of this at all. Let's go back to chapter 20, verse 11, and just remind ourselves of some verses here. We're now going to read about the great white throne. This is a judgment at the end of the millennium. So some people, again, just to remind you that those who are Christ at his coming will be resurrected, and at least some, again, I'm not quite sure exactly where we fit in. We may or may not be part of that. But there are a number of people who will just remain in the ground until there's another general resurrection. Okay, and that's what we're going to read about. The end of the millennial kingdom, just before the New Jerusalem. And that's what we're reading about here. Chapter 20, verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. And it's a bit vague, isn't it? Doesn't tell you a whole lot of details there. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades, which is the grave, you remember, gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So then we start reading about verse 1 of the next chapter. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven, the first earth had passed away. No longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So this is a new phase in God's plans here. Verse 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And what I'm suggesting to you here is that the thief on the cross was promised this, at least this paradise here. Now, why am I making such a fuss of that? Because have you still got Luke 23 in front of you? Or can you get it there? Hopefully you've got it bookmarked. And this has got something to do with what Janelle mentioned before. Look at what the thief actually asks for and look at what he gets. It says, then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That's the kingdom, the 1,000 years. And the Lord says, well, I tell you truly today, you will be with me in paradise. It's something a bit better. Now,
or at least different.
At least different. No, I think it's better. Yeah, but okay. But yes, okay, it's at least different. Now, whether he is also resurrected to the kingdom, I would suspect he would be, but we're not exactly told that. But he will at least be resurrected here into that new heaven and new earth, I think. Into that paradise.
David, just a comment on what John said before about, you know, the thief was essentially given that promise because he stood up for him. But I also think that he's made a statement of faith. By commenting on the fact that he's saying, when you come into your kingdom, he's acknowledging that he is the Christ.
Spot on, I agree. I totally agree. he's acknowledging that this Jesus of Nazareth is in fact the promised king. That's what I think. And it is a real confession. Yes. Yes.
I used to wonder how on earth he would know that, but he just had to look up at the top of the cross. This is the King of the Jews. And he said, Amen.
Yes, he must have had some other knowledge of him, I would think. He knew that he had
situation. I imagine through that whole process of him being nailed to the cross and whatever, there was maybe some indication, some sort of, I don't know, aura that's led him to believe that.
What the only information we're told there is that he chastises the other thief because he's saying, well, you and I, we're guilty. You know you did the wrong thing, and I know I did the wrong thing, but he did nothing wrong. So he knew about his innocence. It's interesting too, I can't think of the whole list off the top of my head here, maybe some of you can help me. There's actually quite a number of people in those last few days of the Lord's life who declare him to be innocent, and they're not all his friends. Pilate's wife is one of them. Have nothing to do with this just man. Judas Iscariot. Judas proclaimed him as innocent. The centurion at the cross. These are people who didn't really have any vested interest in him as such. There's quite a few. I think there's about six or seven anyway. And here's another one where the thief acknowledges his innocence. So he knew something about him, didn't he? Look, the only other occurrence here, I think we've got just enough time to go and have a quick look at this, is in 2 Corinthians 12. The other occurrence of paradise. There's only three, 2 Corinthians 12, there's only three occurrences of paradise in the New Testament. One is the thief on the cross, the other is Revelation 2, where we read about the tree of life in the paradise of God. And the third one here is in 2 Corinthians 12. And we're just about done. We'll read from verse 2. This is Paul writing. And he says, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. There's a lot in this passage I don't understand, by the way. So, chapter 12, verse 2. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise. He heard inexpressible things, things that man is not permitted to tell. I will boast about a man like that, but I will not boast about myself, except about my weaknesses. I'll tell you what I think is actually happening here. I think he's referring to the Apostle John and the visions he had in Revelation. Because he was taken in a vision and shown these things. I don't know if you picked it up there. We probably just read over it very quickly. In Revelation 21, I think he was on a mountain and he was shown these things. It was a vision. He didn't actually go to the day of the Lord so much, but he was shown these visions. And I think this is actually John. And the timing's about right. I think Revelation was very much an Acts period book. I think it was an early Acts period book. Because there's other... talked about it other times. I think it was an early Acts period book. And so let's read it again, and I wonder if it makes sense to you. Yeah. It says, verse 2, I know a man in Christ, and I think that was probably the Apostle John, who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Now, I don't really know anywhere else where it's called the third heaven, but anyway... Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know. God knows, was caught up to paradise. He heard inexpressible things. And a number of times we read John was shown a vision, but he wasn't permitted to write. And a lot of what he did write was in a scroll. It was revealed to him in a scroll, and the scroll wasn't opened. And anyway, there's a number of things that match up with that particular phrase there. Things that a man is not permitted to tell. And he says, I will boast about a man like that, but not about myself. Anyway, so that's the only other verse. So we're not really told a lot about paradise. It's interesting, just as an aside too, that in Genesis, the very first few chapters of Genesis, we read about this garden. There's a tree of life. It's a state of perfection. And then we don't read about it. You know, Adam, of course, is expelled from the garden. And then it crops up right at the very end of things, at the end of Revelation, anyway. Yes, we often talk about paradise lost and paradise restored or paradise regained. And there's definitely a parallel there. There's quite a number of parallels between Genesis and Revelation, actually, and that's one of them. But anyway, look, I think what happened here, what the Lord was saying to the thief in summary, is that firstly the thief acknowledged the Lord's innocence, then he acknowledged the Lord's place as the promised king, and he seems to have recognized something of the Lord's ability to be resurrected, because he says, remember me in your kingdom. So even though he was looking at this man who was only hours away from dying, right, the thief is looking at this man who was only hours away from dying, he recognized that wasn't the end of the road for him. So he knew something about the Lord's resurrection and the ability to be resurrected. The thief believed that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ, the promised king. The thief then asks, remember when you come to your kingdom, but the Lord replies, you will be with me in paradise. And I think that resurrection is perhaps a resurrection to the kingdom, the millennial kingdom, but certainly to the new heavens, new earth, to the new earth, I should say. It's a promise of immortality for his faith. And perhaps just a final thought here, in a similar way, we've also been promised immortality for our faith. When and where we're to be resurrected to immortality, well, we've considered that in earlier studies, but we are nevertheless promised immortality, and we don't deserve it. The thief on the cross committed acts worthy of death, but so have we. Right? The wages of sin is death. The thief's faith was enough to grant him immortal life, and so it is with us as well. Yes.
And if they're promised immortality, why is the tree of life necessary?
I don't know. I think they are, though. I don't know.
Or do they have to partake of the tree of life periodically to continue living?
Ron, you probably know what I'm going to say to this. We are just told so little about what happens in that particular phase of God's dealings. We don't really know too much about the nations. I've given you my 2 cents worth, which may not be correct. We don't know too much about the tree of life, what it does, why it's needed, under what circumstances it's needed. We don't know. We just don't know whether it's a health thing, whether it's to do with actually granting them life in some way, keeping them alive in some way. I don't know. But in that new heavens and new earth, there is no death. There's no pain. There's no death. Sin, death and Hades has been done away with there. So what comes after it? You know, death isn't part of that scene. So how's that for a vague answer? I can't really give you any great insight to that. But death is done away with before this, before we get to that point. All right, folks, look, these are all very interesting thoughts, but we do need to finish some time. One little final thought, which I've already mentioned, but I'll just say it again here, that the thief on the cross, it wasn't too late for him, and he gained forgiveness purely out of belief. He did absolutely nothing to earn his forgiveness, but he was forgiven, wasn't he? Well, the last point in his life, the deathbed confession, so to speak. And, well, we don't deserve life, but thankfully we've been given it too.